Bonnie Lin, Director of the China Power Project and Senior Fellow for Asian Security at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. In this episode of the China Power Podcast, we're discussing U.S.-China technology competition in the artificial intelligence value chain and artificial intelligence more broadly. Here to discuss this and more is Greg Allen, Director of the Wanwani Center for Artificial Intelligence and Advanced Technologies. He's a senior fellow in the Strategic Technologies Program at CSIS. Prior to joining CSIS, he was the Director of Strategy and Policy at the Department of Defense's Joint Artificial Intelligence Center. There, he oversaw development and implementation of DoD's AI strategy. He also drove policy and human capital reforms, developed mechanisms for AI governance and ethics, and led engagements with governments and militaries in Europe and the Indo-Pacific. Greg, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
As we talk about U.S.-China and artificial intelligence, I think it's important to sort of lay the foundations of what exactly is artificial intelligence. And when we think about artificial intelligence vis-a-vis U.S.-China competition, what does that actually mean?
I think the right way to understand artificial intelligence is as a general purpose technology. So it is not a single thing. It is a broad category of types of things. And unfortunately, for anybody who's been trying to pay attention to this topic, you've probably noticed that the definitions have shifted a lot over time. For example, if you've ever used tax preparation software, think like TurboTax, that type of product. Well, that was extremely successfully marketed as artificial intelligence back in the 1980s, right? And in that regard, it was new. You had this computer software that if you put in all of your tax forms, it would spit out, you know, the forms that you needed to submit to the IRS. And so previously, only human accountants could do this. So it must be artificial intelligence. But really, you know, in the 1980s, it was just traditional software. It was just traditional software combined with the knowledge of human experts executing, you know, a series of rules. Well, in the past decade or so, a different approach to artificial intelligence based around machine learning has seen absolutely extraordinary improvements in performance and improvements in practical application for a really diverse set of problems. So whether it's facial recognition, voice recognition, text generation, text summarization, strategy game playing, there's just this really long list of stuff that used to be basically impossible to deal with traditional computer software. But if you find the right way to structure the problem as a machine learning challenge, where humans aren't writing out every one of the rules in computer code, but instead the system is learning those rules based on a training data set, well, then the performance of these AI systems can go through the roof. And that's really the story of the past 12 years or so, is that machine learning has seen this really extraordinary growth in relevance and performance to this really broad set of applications. And in terms of what it means for competition between the United States and China, I agree with those who view this as sort of analogous to electricity or computer software. You know, this is a general purpose technology that will end up having some kind of impact on basically every other aspect of the economy or every other aspect of military power. Try and think of a weapons system that doesn't involve computers at some stage in its life cycle. You know, maybe it's an aircraft and there's computers on board, or maybe it's a bullet that was just designed on computers. And I think the same is broadly going to be true of artificial intelligence, in that just about everything the military does over the next few decades is going to involve artificial intelligence to some greater or lesser extent.
So Greg, you mentioned you had worked in DoD and you're very much also analyzing how other countries and other militaries are using artificial intelligence. As you look at China's prioritization of artificial intelligence, do you view that China is prioritizing it as important as the US military, or more or about the same?
Well, in the formal sense of the word, I would say they're basically equivalent, which is that for both countries, it's their sort of stated top priority. If you look at China's five-year plan, and this is an economic plan, AI is the first technology priority listed in the most recent five-year economic plan. In the case of the United States, in the Department of Defense, the previous Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, as well as the multiple prior Secretaries of Defense, and now Lloyd Austin as well, all of whom have stated that artificial intelligence is either the number one or the number two technology modernization priority of the Department of Defense as a whole. With respect to, you know, China, they don't like list their technology modernization priorities in a ranked way that I'm aware of in terms of the People's Liberation Army. But it is very clear from a ton of different senior leadership speeches, as well as sort of where the money is going and what capabilities are being advertised, that artificial intelligence modernization is a legitimate top priority, the People's Liberation Army. But I do want to say that, you know, there's a difference between this is a priority because we say it's a priority, and this is a priority, and you could look at our budget and know that it's a priority. The vast majority of the Department of Defense budget, at least when it comes to research and development and technology procurement type spending, is really wrapped up in legacy programs like aircraft carriers and aircraft and ships, all of which were, you know, designed before the modern AI revolution. Those programs are sort of going through their pre-existing life cycle. So it depends a little bit on what you mean by priority, but it is very clear that, you know, this topic has the attention of the senior leaders in both countries.
And do you have a sense, looking at China's defense spending, that China is actually putting renminbi to artificial intelligence?
Well, to the extent that China's defense spending is public, which is not very at all. So I think it's really tough to say, you know, how much is China's military spending on this? China's government is certainly spending an extraordinary amount of it on this. I mean, the AI-based domestic surveillance operation alone is in the billions or tens of billions of dollars to sort of build out this surveillance infrastructure. So it is definitely the case that, you know, the Chinese national security establishment is spending extraordinary amounts of money on this. With respect to, you know, how much the military, the Chinese military, is specifically spending on this, I don't really think there are good unclassified estimates on that.
And can I ask probably a relatively basic question? So when you talk about how much China has been spending on facial recognition, you also talked about how different AI applications can be, both on the economic side, but also on the military side. So at least from your assessment, does China's spending on facial recognition, on domestic surveillance, does that actually translate to a military capability if they wanted to use it?
Only indirectly, at best. The reason for that is that bureaucratically, the MSS in China and the PLA in China, they both report up through the same to the same leader, but they are fundamentally different institutions. But the way that there is this sort of indirect benefit is as follows. You know, first, there's an entire generation of Chinese Communist Party officials and government officials in national security bureaucracies who are gaining sort of operational experience with what it's like to deploy AI technology and to use AI technology in an operational circumstance. Now, facial recognition uses facial recognition data. You can't use it to create missile guidance systems. You need missile guidance data for that. But at the same time, there's a lot of best practices in program management that is a little bit more data agnostic. Similarly, there's a lot of computing infrastructure that is agnostic. And so what you've seen is a lot of these companies like iFlytek and SenseTime, get really good at these sort of subdomains of AI technology, whether it's computer vision or speech recognition and translation. Because they have these massive contracts with the MSS, they really get tied into China's program of military-civil fusion and providing technology to the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese government as a customer. And that means that they have a lot of relevant capability that they can then go after military problem sets. And so this is why I mean that there is definitely a benefit, but it's an indirect benefit, but I don't think that means it's an inconsequential benefit.
Thank you. I also wanted to, before we go into more depth on analyzing what China is doing, I also wanted to...
More in depth than this?
Have you defined what is the actual AI value chain? I know you've written and talked quite a bit about that, and that relates to some of our discussion later about semiconductors. Could you give us a sense of what is part of the AI value chain and why is it important to focus on the value chain?
Sure. So I think the first thing to point out here is that all AI software has to run somewhere on semiconductor hardware. Semiconductors are computer chips and the sort of related technologies. When you're developing an AI system, and I'm going to describe what it's like for a supervised machine learning system. It's a little bit different for an unsupervised or a reinforcement learning type system. But essentially, you gather a lot of data, and then you then label that data. So this could be, for example, let's just keep with the facial recognition example. You go, you get a lot of pictures of faces, and then you label those faces according to, you know, whatever you want. So for example, if it's find the face in this image, you would label in this image, where is the face? Or if it's identify this specific person, you would give it a lot of labels. Here are pictures of faces, and here's the correct label, you know, for who that person is in that facial image. So first, you got to go get a lot of data. Then you've got to label all of this data. Then you've got to feed that labeled data to a machine learning algorithm. And this is sort of where the programming in the system takes place, because rather than a traditional sort of rules-based software framework where a human being types out every individual line of computer code in order to write the rules of the system is essentially programming itself based on what it learns from that data. And then the output of that training process is what is called an AI model. And the AI model is basically just a piece of software that is now in our example, a face recognizer. And now this is a piece of software that you can then deploy into a data center that is hooked up to a network of surveillance cameras. That was sort of how you train and deploy the model. But there are sort of two important things to remember is that one, training tends to be super computationally intensive. So if you want to train, you know, on a billion images of faces, you're going to need a pretty beefy data center that's capable of handling that much data. Inference, which is when you're sort of operationally using the model after it's been trained, tends to be significantly less computationally intensive. That's why you can have, you know, face recognition on your iPhone, but it would be really tough to train an entire face recognition model on your iPhone. But in both cases, having sort of advanced semiconductor chips tends to be really important. And so that's why the October 7th export controls, in which the United States restricted access to advanced semiconductor technology for export to China, that was a semiconductor policy, but in a sense, the semiconductor was just the means to an end. The policy was actually trying to influence the trajectory of China's AI ecosystem.
And you recently wrote, my understanding, a very well-received report on sort of how China has responded to the October 7th U.S. policy. And in that report, you mentioned that you saw the October 7th U.S. policy as a major reversal 25 years of U.S. trade and technology policy. Could you share with us what you're seeing in terms of the Chinese response to the U.S. policy? And what does that mean for what China might do, broadly speaking, in terms of U.S.-China tech competition?
Sure. So to begin, I think this policy really was one of the two most important things that happened in international relations last year, the other being Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But in this policy in which the United States export-controlled semiconductor technology exports to China, it was in one sense narrowly targeted because it only went after high-end chips and the most advanced categories of technology to create chips. But on the other hand, as you mentioned, right, it was a significant reversal of 25 years of U.S. trade and technology policy towards China in that it restricted exports not on a no military end user, no military end use basis, but to China as an entire geography. Like that was, it was a geographic-based restriction, which historically had not been done for dual-use items. And similarly, the, you know, the policy actively tried to degrade the current state of the art, not in all domains, but in some domains, especially chip manufacturing in China. And so, as you can imagine, when faced with such a significant policy, it has been a significant response in China to this. And it takes a little while for them to sort of move through their own policy response and figure out how they're responding. But in the paper, I point out that I think there's really five sort of broad categories of tactics that I think China has adopted. And that's one, just seeking to evade the controls through both legal and illegal means. And so that includes like accessing computing capacity through the cloud or smuggling the chips illegally to continue getting access. The other four items are seeking to divide the United States from its allies, because the United States has been working very hard to make this a multilateral export control policy. China wants to stop that. The third is acquiring foreign technology through industrial espionage and talent recruitment. This is a really big deal. During the Cold War, I actually found a declassified CIA report that said the number one technology acquisition priority of the Soviet Union was semiconductor manufacturing equipment. And surprise, surprise, I think we're right back there right now, where I would say the number one industrial espionage priority of the Chinese government is related to semiconductor technology. The fourth mechanism is pressuring Chinese firms to buy Chinese and eliminate American suppliers. This is the de-Americanization phenomenon that I think you've been seeing in the news, some of which, you know, spawned by this report. And then finally is retaliating directly against the United States and our allies, both through initiating the cybersecurity review of U.S. memory chip maker Micron, that could potentially, you know, if this review proceeds all the way through, just ban Micron from the Chinese market entirely. And then the other way they're retaliating is by refusing to approve any merger between two companies where one of those companies is an American chip maker. And that might not sound like that big of a deal, but it actually is a huge deal in terms of allowing chip makers to acquire capabilities that they need to keep pushing their technology forward. And it was always moving slow, and now it's been entirely stopped. Pretty clear that China is doing that as retaliation for October 7th.
I want to go back to each of your different points and ask you for a bit more information. So when you talk about that one of the first strategies China is doing is to evade the legal requirements, what exactly do you see as the more successful methods that China is trying to do this?
Sure. So I think there's legal ways to try and get around the controls, and then there's also illegal ways to get around the controls. So, for example, on the legal side, the chip restrictions were based upon the certain performance thresholds. So chips above the performance thresholds are not allowed to be sold to China. Chips below the performance thresholds are allowed to be sold to China. And so there are now these sort of categories of chips that are marketed as AI development chips, but they comply with those performance restrictions. And so it is not illegal for Chinese companies to buy these chips or even to design these chips. That is part of their strategy to continue accessing the technology, but it's not like illegal evasion. Similarly, China can continue to buy computing capacity through the cloud. So if there is a large-scale data center cluster in, just hypothetically, Singapore, Chinese companies can train an AI model on the cloud in Singapore and then bring the results of that training for operational use in China. And again, this is not an illegal evasion. It's explicitly allowed by the policy, but it does have sort of a material impact into China's potential AI trajectory. And then there's the illegal means. This is like setting up shell companies where Chinese firms or Chinese government entities will say that they are a data center in Singapore, but actually they're just a front company for the Chinese government. And then those chips will then be rerouted to China. So that's export control evasion. There's also smuggling, where you steal the chips and, you know, smuggle them over the border into China. And there's definitely indication that this is going on as well.
It would seem to me that tracking the illegal means, whether it's shell company or smuggling, is probably relatively difficult with public data. But as you said, you're already seeing indications of this.
Well, I would say it is tough. And I do think that, you know, Chinese export control evasion networks have grown in sophistication. But I am not among those who think that we should give up. The sort of common criticism of what it's like to do export controls is that it's a whack-a-mole problem. And a lot of people say, oh, it's a whack-a-mole problem. You shouldn't try and do that. I have the exact opposite opinion. It's a whack-a-mole problem. We need to get really, really good at whacking moles. Like, that's just what national security requires at this moment. And so that's why, you know, in a paper that I did with Emily Benson here at CSIS that came out last year, we talked a lot about how actually the United States Department of Commerce could take advantage of AI technology and machine learning technology and modern data science techniques to do a better job harvesting the data sets that are available, both in the open source as well as in the private sector, to do a better job of enforcing export controls and detecting these shell companies. I mean, right now, China can set up some of these shell companies in a matter of weeks. And so we need to be able to detect these companies and identify them in a relevant time frame. And that, I think that just requires more resources and different types of talent at the Department of Commerce.
The second point you had was to divide U.S. allies. Did you mean U.S. allies just in terms of countries that are major chip exporters, or is it much broader than that?
So I would say that the biggest focus is actually on the chip making equipment. So the October 7th export controls are really an interlocking architecture export controls. So you want to stop China from buying these high-end AI chips, but then you also don't want anybody else to sell those chips to China. And then you don't want China to be able to make those chips themselves, which means they would need the equipment. And then that means you don't want them to be able to make the equipment themselves. And so there's this element to the policy where if you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound. If you want to cut off access to the chips, you kind of necessarily have to try and cut off access to chip making equipment and all this other stuff as well. Otherwise, the policy is really just the United States shooting itself in its foot. And then there's a multilateral dimension because the United States is the most important global supplier of chip making equipment, but we're not the only important supplier of chip making equipment. Japan, the Netherlands are the other sort of two biggest suppliers of chip making equipment. But South Korea is also present in this market. Germany is also present in this market. And so that's why the October 7th export controls were initially adopted on a unilateral basis. But the United States has been trying earnestly to get allies to adopt equivalent export controls. And in fact, earlier this year, Japan and the Netherlands did announce export controls on chip making equipment. They did not mention China. They did not mention the United States, because I think they had sort of diplomatic positioning that they wanted to achieve with their new export controls. But broadly, if you look at these export controls, they do appear to be aligned both in technological performance level and also efficacy with those of the United States. And China has noticed this. And despite the fact that the controls did not mention China, there's been some very explicit threats by the Chinese foreign policy community, including this really colorful quote that I included in the paper, where the Chinese foreign minister said to his Japanese counterpart, "Do not help a villain do evil." The villain in that story is the United States. China has also stated explicitly to the Netherlands that there will be some kind of retaliatory response, which we have already seen the retaliation, or at least the beginnings of it, to the United States. We have not yet seen the retaliation towards the Dutch and the Japanese, if such retaliation is coming.
Great. Thank you. Are we also concerned at all that China might encourage third countries to purchase, whether it's chip making equipment, and then resell it to China? Is that a potential pathway?
Yeah. So I would put that in the same category as export control evasion through shell companies. Sort of third party countries, or the term of art in export controls is transshipment countries, is a very well-known problem, and it's a very real problem. If you look at the Russian export controls evasion network, third-party transshipment countries is a big part of the problem there. And I would say it's a bigger problem in the case of the chips than it is the chip-making equipment. Chips are small, relatively lightweight, and reasonably valuable. Smugglers love that. But the chip-making equipment is colossal, extremely difficult to operate and requires a ton of post-sale service and support. It's not like the equipment manufacturer sort of drops off this stuff at your factory and then says, see you in 5 years when you want the new model. They basically move into your factory and they're helping you with troubleshooting the operations of the equipment, training your employees on the equipment, providing spare parts, providing software updates. I mean, the most advanced semiconductor equipment manufacturers, they know where every single one of their machines is on Earth. And so that is a much easier export controls enforcement challenge than controlling the chips, which, you know, as I said, they're small and lightweight and you can hide them and stuff, you know, as part of normal flow of trade. So it's a tougher enforcement challenge for sure.
Greg, you mentioned the U.S. focus on limiting China's ability to acquire chips and chip making equipment. Some have argued that the United States hasn't done enough to limit the flow of human capital to China. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I would disagree. So the October 7th export controls included a provision, what is often called in this community, the U.S. persons restriction. And it basically makes it subject to a license condition. You have to go apply for an export license if you want to provide consulting services to Chinese chip-making fabs or chip equipment companies. And this is actually, you know, a pretty novel expansion of export controls. There's always been a sort of knowledge element to export controls. You can't sell nukes and you can't sell the blueprints to nukes either. That's always sort of been a part of the export controls. But this entire U.S. persons restriction and, you know, restricting the ability of U.S. citizens or U.S. companies or employees of U.S. companies to assist in the development of China's chipmaking industry above the technology performance thresholds specified in the October 7th regulations, it's actually a pretty expansive use. And in that regard, I think it is designed to limit the ability of China to access U.S. expertise in order to develop the talent of its own workforce. That is still a real challenge. I would say the biggest challenge in this regard is really coming from Taiwan, where there has been this really dedicated recruitment campaign by Chinese chip-making companies, where they even, you know, they set up these quote-unquote consulting firms in Taiwan, so you don't even have to leave your country, and all you do all day, every day is video teleconference calls with your Chinese employer, and they're basically sucking all the knowledge out of your brain, trying to extract that know-how for the development of Chinese chip-making companies. And I think this is really bad for Taiwan. So much of their national security is really derived from the so-called Silicon Shield, which depends upon their superiority and their criticality in the global semiconductor value chain. And so the Taiwanese government is pursuing all kinds of new restrictions on the ability to transfer chip technology know-how to China. And I expect them to do more in this area. The other countries where sort of similar considerations are coming into play would be like Korea. I think there's plenty more to do in this.
Great, thank you. So in terms of personnel and expertise, you're saying that the United States at least is starting to work with Taiwan and Korea. When we're talking about the U.S. persons condition, you mentioned that was mainly restricting U.S. personnel or personnel working in U.S. companies from consulting with China. And then you mentioned one of the challenges Taiwan faces is sort of the brain drain without actual need for people to actually leave Taiwan.
Just to elaborate on that for 1 second, like we're talking a five-fold improvement in salary when you go work for a Chinese company, because they know that the quality of the Taiwanese workforce, the quality of the Korean workforce is significantly higher than what's available in China. And they got a lot of Chinese government subsidies to pay for these workers. So it is very lucrative to do this, you know, with the caveat that once they've sucked all the knowledge out of your brain, it's not a job for life. Like they fire you when that process is over.
You were mentioning that the Taiwan government has started to move in this direction, in terms of taking measures to prevent Taiwan citizens from engaging in these types of activities. And you mentioned that Korea is starting to move in that direction. But how far is Korea and to what extent is the U.S. government working with our allies and partners broadly on this?
So I think the United States is not really leading this charge. I think they're probably supportive and encouraging of this type of activity. But I think Taiwan views it as sort of a domestic issue. And the types of restrictions that are either under consideration or have passed are stuff like, if you have received money from the Taiwanese government for research and development activities in the semiconductor field, which is a ton of the Chinese semiconductor field has received, you know, these government research subsidies, then you must request a visa 60 days prior to travel to China. I mean, that's a pretty extraordinary restriction. And then similarly, you know, these consulting firms, the Taiwanese government has been raiding some of these firms for violating the knowledge transfer exports restrictions that already exist in Taiwan. So it's also a whack-a-mole type problem, but Taiwan is getting a little bit serious about it. In Korea, I think they're a little bit less far along, at least in terms of the sort of legal restrictions around this. But I think they also recognize, because there's plenty of markets where Korean companies have been sort of beaten out by Chinese companies, and poaching talent has been a big part of that story. I'm thinking like LCD screens, TVs, handsets, like mobile phones. There's a lot of market subsegments where Chinese competitors have been just growing in sophistication and competitiveness, and knowledge transfer from Korea has played a big part in that. And so I think the Korean government is sort of reassessing what is actually in their self-interest.
Thank you. I want to go back to the fifth point you mentioned in terms of the Chinese strategy, and that was retaliating against the United States. And all the examples that you gave were very targeted, right, against either U.S. firms involved in semiconductors or against U.S. chip makers. Do you see so far any indications that China wants to expand the retaliation beyond just the semiconductor industry?
Not so far. There is definitely discussion in Chinese media and sort of think tank policy community about undertaking sort of more broad brush retaliation. The one that comes up all the time in conversations is exploiting China's leadership in rare earth minerals, for example, and especially rare earth refining capacity. But I think the United States really has escalation dominance in this regard. And what I mean by that is the United States knows how to build a mine. The United States knows how to build a mineral refining capacity. And it's not instantaneous by any means, but a lot of the reasons why it takes a long time are bureaucratic and regulatory in nature. And so if we were to pull out all the stops in a crisis, we could do that relatively quickly. By contrast, China, when it comes to chip making equipment, they pulled out all the stops a long time ago. They've been pumping literally hundreds of billions of dollars into this sector. And the marginal utility of those investments has been pretty low. Really, like, you know, if they give you $1, that doesn't help a lot. If they give you $1 billion, well, that helps a lot. But going from $1 to $1 billion helps a lot more than going from $99 billion to $100 billion. And in that regard, the sort of marginal investment appears to just be fueling corruption pretty directly. Making chip making equipment is insanely, preposterously hard. I mean, it is like the James Webb Space Telescope hard. It is like the CERN Large Hadron Collider hard. These are among the most complicated machines that humanity makes. And China is not close to making these machines. That's what I mean when I say we have escalation dominance, because if push came to shove, we could develop alternative sources of rare earth minerals. Push has already come to shove, and China really can't develop this chip equipment sector.
Thank you, Greg. I want to transition now from semiconductors and the AI value chain to broadly discussing China's artificial intelligence. So some in the United States and elsewhere have argued that China has advantage in artificial intelligence compared to the United States. There's a variety of reasoning for that, and some have attributed to China's authoritarian system. How do you assess the broader U.S.-China competition on AI, and particularly where China is vis-a-vis the United States?
I think the only truly correct answer here is a rather unsatisfying, it depends. When you say that China's leading, what do you mean by leading? If it's in terms of who is driving the most astonishing research breakthroughs in AI, I think that's pretty clearly, you know, the United States and European organizations, especially in the private sector, companies like OpenAI or Google DeepMind. They're the ones who are delivering the sort of breakthroughs in large language models and other stuff that you're constantly seeing in the news. And more likely than not, your listeners are using in terms of ChatGPT. And China in that sort of area tends to be a fast follower rather than a leader. But if you're talking about sort of broad economic adoption and penetration of AI capabilities, you know, here China is extremely strong. And there's just an awful lot of businesses across all of the Chinese economy in sort of business-to-business sectors or business-to-consumer sectors where AI has been incorporated into just almost every kind of digital product and service that you can imagine. And then finally, there's the sort of government and military adoption of AI. And here I would say that, you know, China's most significant government adoption of AI is domestic surveillance and population control for both facial recognition and physical security and population tracking type things, but also government censorship. And I want to point out that whether or not you think that these applications are profoundly unethical, they are still a large-scale AI deployment project, and they include all of the challenges that government bureaucrats working with private sector companies face when they're trying to pull off a large-scale AI deployment effort. And so in that regard, you know, there's tens of thousands of Chinese government officials who have some real experience using AI in an operational capacity. And then on the military side, it's a little bit tough. I'm a former U.S. Department of Defense official, so I'm restricted in what I can say to only those sort of unclassified data points on this subject. But I think the highest level, it's extremely clear that the senior leadership of China's military believes that AI is foundational to the future of economic and military power. And in terms of the data points that are available in the unclassified domain, in terms of the types of weapon systems that Chinese companies market at international arms sale expos, or the marketing materials of Chinese weapons manufacturers, or the procurement records, the People's Liberation Army, the ones that are public, it's very clear that they're headed in a direction where AI is increasingly central to their military power.
Thank you, Greg. Let me wrap up this podcast with a final question to you where China might be headed with artificial intelligence. You had discussed how G7 countries are gathering together to discuss regulations and how to regulate the development of AI. How do you view China in this respect? Do you see discussions in China about norms or regulations and ethics more broadly with respect to artificial intelligence?
So I think there's multiple things in your question there that are worth talking about. The first is that there is a Chinese regulatory posture towards AI. There is even discussions of AI ethics in China. I think one super important caveat is that I've seen no evidence that this includes the national security establishment of China. And when I was in the Department of Defense, I was the guy who tried to initiate a conversation between the United States Department of Defense and the People's Liberation Army on military AI risk reduction and AI safety. And they refused every single overture that we put in that regard. Where I've seen restrictions on Chinese companies, I have not seen restrictions on the Chinese government, especially not anything related to national security. The second thing is this sort of is China's restrictions, which the restrictions that are getting a lot of attention in Western policy circles right now are restrictions around conformity to Chinese Communist Party propaganda. You know, in the same way that a company like OpenAI, which makes ChatGPT, they don't want their system spouting pornographic content or violent promoting content or racist content. Well, the Chinese government is trying to ensure that Chinese AI developers don't spout any content that is objectionable to the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party. And because they are taking rapid regulatory measures in this direction, you know, saying that there will be significant fines if anybody's AI model spouts anti-communist sentiment, I have seen analysis in the media sort of saying that, oh, China is actually the responsible actor here. China is actually handicapping its own AI development. And I just really profoundly disagree here. For one thing, from a technical perspective, it's not clear to me that stopping the AI system from promoting pornography or violence or racism is any different, just again, from a technological perspective, from preventing the system from promoting anything that's objectionable to the Chinese Communist Party. I think that Chinese AI companies and Western AI companies are sort of tackling a similar technological challenge in terms of objectionable content. And then sort of secondarily on, you know, where is this going? It's extremely clear the Chinese military thinks that this is foundational to the future of military power. And the restrictions that I've seen, I've seen no evidence of any restrictions that apply to China's military community. And as I said, even when we just tried to have a conversation about this topic, they refused.
Well, Greg, thank you very much. I do want to add that it's not uncommon for the PLA to refuse to engage on whatever topic the United States wants to engage with them on.
To their own detriment, I would honestly argue. I mean, even on the pretty win-win areas of conversation. But, you know, you're the expert on that one.
Thank you very much, Greg, for this very wide-ranging conversation on artificial intelligence, semiconductors, as well as broadly U.S.-China technology competition.
Thanks for having me so much. And for folks who were curious, the report is up on csis.org.